Welcome to O Types Rising, the podcast where we dive deep into the minds of big picture thinkers who thrive on curiosity, dot connection, and challenging the status quo. I'm your host, Jen Rice. In each episode, we'll explore the strengths, strategies, and challenges of O types who are shaping the future of business. All right. I am here with Ron Kursik. And Ron is a futuring architect. And I'd love for Ron to actually fill us in on what that is.
Well, yeah, fantastic. Thank you for having me. It's a bit of a guilty pleasure. Yeah, so futuring architect, right? So I have to admit, I kind of made up the phrase futuring architectures for sustaining transitions as the flag to cover what it is that I do. And what I do is I try to understand technology as it pops up on the horizon. And I try to build narratives around that technology, what it could be and for whom it could be and what it would take to actually have it be so mature that people can start working with it and who should start working with it. And I work to make sure that the narrative is so compelling that people want to join on their journey in making this technology come true. Hence the futuring architectures, and it has to be plural because there is always many futures. And you will see probably also in this discussion, I hate certainty and I hate selling certainty. And I kind of have a disdain for people that traffic in certainty. So that's my bias. So please be warned.
Lovely. Well, I think that O-types in general are more comfortable in ambiguity.
Yeah, for sure.
So in terms of ecosystem, so you and I have had many chats on different digital media around ecosystems and keystones. Why don't you talk a little bit about the ecosystem interest? Where did it emerge?
Yeah, this is actually a decade-long journey, right? Because I can actually remember reading your pieces on ecosystems, what, 2019?
Yeah.
Which is half a decade ago, right? So I started my career in the previous century as a programmer, right? Not as a software engineer, but as a programmer. In the previous episode from John Durant, he actually mentioned that programming used to be this very solitary activity. This hacker sitting in the basement working all alone. That was me. I really had to smile when I heard him mention that one. And I think what you see in software programming, even in the 80s, there is a strong sense to open things up, right? Open source, that code is available for anyone, well, to read, but also to use, apply, remix, riff, and give back to the community, right? So you already have a very strong awareness that there is around, in this case, programming, a network of people, some closer connected, somewhat bit looser, some in a more dominant role than actually to make something and to make something great, like for instance, the Apache web server or Linux, the operating system. It actually takes a system of people, of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that, of course, is the whole notion of there is an ecosystem and nobody designed that ecosystem. Nobody owns that ecosystem. I would say even the Linux ecosystem is not owned by Mr. Linus, even though he can be rather forceful, not forceful enough to actually own this ecosystem. So this almost amorphous, ill-defined, ever-changing concept of an ecosystem, part of my work. And what you saw, let's say, in the 2000s, when I became interested in platforms as a way to organize ecosystems, right? I really see a platform as an organizational model. So the whole concept of a large number of people in all the various capacities and their own jobs to be done, collaborating on something bigger, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. I think it's very obvious to me, and it has been for quite some time. And that's why the word ecosystem still figures in my thinking. And that's why I spent, well, almost a decade of my professional life on understanding and then advocating and at times shaping platforms as a way to help organize ecosystem to a certain shared goal.
Amazing. And yes, back in 2019, I was looking at platforms and thinking, this is fascinating because platforms are used in technology and in manufacturing and in business models. And there's always a completely different definition of platform whenever it is used. And I just see a platform as it's an immovable foundation that provides the rules and guidelines for whatever sits on top. And so it makes a lot of sense to think about platform as it relates to any ecosystem. And it doesn't have to be the matching kind of like an Uber, right? Or Airbnb. It can actually also be that the organization is an ecosystem. Pretty much any business larger than a two pizza team, right, is technically a complex system. So how do you define the roles?
Yeah. And I would even say that Uber really isn't a platform, but maybe that's for another podcast.
Yeah. So you're dealing with ecosystems in two ways. One is internally with your work at ING, and the other is externally with your work with startups and scale-ups. So I'd love to talk about both. So why don't we talk about ING first?
Yeah. Yes, I'm in the tech group at ING. I mean, pretty much all products and services we put out there are in some shape or form enabled and sometimes even mediated via digital technology. And what I see, well, again, this futuring architectures thing, I'm really motivated to see what's around the corner for technology. Like, for instance, generative AI was already in 2021, 2022. And what would that mean for us? What would it mean for the products and services we offer? How we offer them? To whom we offer those products? And especially what it means for how we organize internally, but also with stake and shareholders in actually creating a product or a service. So I think the aspect of organizing with technology, I think that's rather prominent in my work. I mean, maybe instead of a futuring architect, I'm an organizational designer. I'm just trading one pretentious phrase for another. I know, but that's a large part of my work. In the end, to be an advocate of the potential in near future technology. So things are inevitably hitting on our shores. How are we going to respond? Are we going to respond? With whom? How? Where? When? What? These kind of questions.
Yeah. And so you're working directly with the business teams outside of the tech.
Absolutely. I very much look for pull and not for push. So if there was an org chart, I want to be this isolated island. So there is no power conveyed in that role. So that you can measure your success and your usefulness basically by the amount of pull you experience. Do people actually want to work with you? Are people curious to what is he all about?
Now, you said earlier that there is a mindset around ecosystem, that it's not we are at the center of the universe, we are the sun, but rather we are part of a broader ecosystem. Wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
You can see that I'm a technologist, but I think this mindset is quite strong in software engineering. Because if you are a software engineer nowadays, you are so aware that you're part of something bigger. And I strongly believe that it's on us, on technologists, to actually get this mindset articulated to the people who are, well, less versed in this way of thinking because they don't have this technology background, because they have a background where things are more siloed, more controlled, more linear, more industrial. So I think there it's on the technology people to actually get clear that this mindset is valuable in the current day and age. And I believe this mindset is worth advocating for. Because any business is in some shape or form predicated on technology. So this ecosystem aspect of technology siphons through anyway, right? So we better understand it and accept it and actually embrace it. Saying that.
And then, of course, most digital transformations fail because it's not just about the technology, it's about the people willing to adopt.
Absolutely.
Even the mindset, right? Like, which comes first, the mindset or technology?
Yeah, I think it goes hand in hand, right? And I think that the best way to convince people is to actually see how easy it is to start participating in ecosystem and how easy it is to share and it is not threatening per se. But just as an example from the financial industries, right? I mean, in Europe, we have Payment Service Directive number 2 that actually mandates that banks publish 3 of their capabilities as APIs for others to use. If you would read that regulation, the opening paragraph actually mentions outside innovation on top of our capabilities. They don't say ecosystems, but for sure that's what they hint at. And that's logical given the nature of technology. It's very hard to not think about an ecosystem in digital capabilities.
One of the things that I thought was pretty brilliant about Amazon, Jeff Bezos mandating that every internal department needed to essentially create a function as a service, right? Make everything externalizable, accessible by other departments, which then ultimately enabled them to offer and monetize internal services.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the all-time great business moves, I think, that legendary and maybe not real memo from Jeff Bezos. And item number 7 on the memo, you will get fired over this. That is truly a visionary move.
So thinking about visionary, what's on your horizon?
Okay, I feel now somewhat guilty in mentioning AI. See, I'm actually, you can see
quite
my soul was going
everybody's
now.
Everybody's on everybody's horizon.
The reason why I want to bring this up and the reason why I'm tracking it so intensely is that you can so see how we are stuck in the industrial mindset. I mean, pretty much anything I read about generative AI is about things being more productive. Do more with fewer people, right? And that could very well be true with various forms of technology, but not with generative AI. It's a very different technology. It is a technology that doesn't calculate formulas. It doesn't calculate things that have to be correct and are correct and that you can inspect its correctness for. No, it creates things that look eerily real. Look eerily real. It creates things that are plausible, not correct. It isn't trained to be correct. It's trained to be plausible. And of course, if you are trained on all the text and all the images and all the video on the World Wide Web, there are some really weird things in there. So now you have technology that creates really weird things. We call them hallucinations and we think, bad hallucination, bad AI, don't do this. Fantastic. For the first time, I have a computer that just makes things up. And sometimes it makes things up that are bland. Sometimes things that makes up are obviously wrong. And sometimes make things up that I think, that's interesting. It's not quite what I was looking for, but let's ask another question. So, and it helps me getting to a better question. This is a long-winded answer that I think in generative AI, we will see that we're going to rethink our relationship with the computer. So instead of the computer as an oracle, the computer is right, right? And if the computer says no, it is no. If the computer says, turn left in this street, you turn left, even though there is a sign, no left turning here, right? You do it because how could my navigation system be wrong? And now you have a computer that is more like a muse. It's for inspiration. It's for creativity. It's for me not getting a better answer or a faster answer or more accurate answer, but for me finding out what's the right question to ask. So instead of going downstream to an answer, it goes upstream to questions. What do I think is worthwhile pursuing? What do I think is right? What do I think is useful, usable, or even tasteful? So I think we will see maybe a renaissance, I think, of instead of people being judged, paid, hired for skills, they will be judged, paid, hired for their taste. And I'm pausing for dramatic effect now. And I think that is such a reversal of, let's say, our current way of organizing, such a reversal, such an antidote to the current, it's almost 100 years old, industrial corporation and the effects on society at large and how we see jobs and how we position ourselves in the job market will change drastically. And I think also who gets to do what, right? I mean, software engineering still is a very specialized business to be practiced by software engineers with a specific background, specific humor, more often than not, right? And maybe not by design, but it isn't an inclusive community in and by itself. And now I can see technology coming along where people who are not software engineers can make good enough software. And maybe not software that actually addresses, let's say, 1 billion daily active users, but maybe software just for me or my family or the niche I happen to occupy with only 100 practitioners worldwide. So the smiling curve, right, at the aggregators at one end, the Googles, etc., they won't go away. But at the other end, the individual, let's call them creators, that actually can start making a living from their taste or intuition, from the way they collaborate with their communities, with the people that actually choose to be with them. So I really think that generative AI will have a massive impact, just not the kind of impact that's being advocated, let's say, generally in media or by the various AI companies. I don't see AGI coming along, but this creativity thing, I think it's going to be fantastic.
I think this is yet another example of we have this potential for the technology, depending on how we use it. When I look at the difference between O-type specifically, we tend to go really deep. We want to know how things work and why things work. And we like to go into understanding root causes. We're much more likely to dive into those details. And then you have a lot of people who are using it just as, well, this is what it told me to do. Very unquestioning, yep. Right? So how do we balance and make sure that it really can be used to its full potential instead of it being so misused and in a really shallow way? And there's a question that I have in my head around whether generative AI will end up averaging everything out instead of really highlighting a lot of differences in creativity.
Well, the answer is yes on both. It's going to be both, right? Because in the end, this is technology that averages things out because it creates things that fit with the observed training set. I call that nostalgia in, nostalgia out, right? Which is a form of averaging. But of course, you can take this technology and you can make it special. But it's you. It's your taste, it's your intuition, it's your drive, it's your vision in the end that can pull this technology in directions would never have gone all by itself. Right? You can actually start working with this technology, iteratively, searching for something that sparkles for you. Instead of asking for a quick question and be done with it, spend time to understand what's actually the question I should have been asking. What it is actually what I'm curious about? What is it actually what I'm addressing? Who am I addressing this to? What would resonate with them? So this whole reasoning iteratively take time to actually get to something when you intuitively say, that's it, because you just know. And that's what I meant with taste, but maybe intuition is a better one. But taste agonizes certain people. So that's a nice way to actually have a discussion, right? I mean, you have actually people that tell me I don't have any taste. Well, you do. Long story short, yes, it's going to be averaging out and it's going to be a great amplifier for those that want to execute on their tastefulness. It's going to be both.
Anything else? Everybody is really focused on Gen AI, but there's multiple types of AI. There's all kinds of interesting tech on the horizon. Curious what else is on your radar.
I'm going to disappoint you. I think, yes, there are, but this is such a specific technology that literally breaks with 60 years of computing, right? I mean, the very first computers, they were all there to calculate a formula, literally. Right? I mean, so do an insurance risk calculation. And that's what we have been doing for more than 60 years, calculating formulas more accurately, more faster or cheaper. And now you have something that doesn't calculate a formula, that doesn't calculate an answer that needs to be correct and that we can specify what correct means. No, it literally makes things up. And this is such a breaking change, and it's very hard to actually let go of our legacy of how a computer works. I mean, the fact that we call it hallucinating, right? I mean, there's judgment already in that phrase. And then sometimes it does things well, and oh, apparently it ate some mushrooms and now it's a bit off. No, but it's exactly the same process each and every time. And that something is useful is almost like a secondary spin-off. So everything I'm now tracking on my radar, and I literally have a radar, derives from this. But I mean, why do we have large industrial corporations? Well, you have all these supporting departments, like HR, like legal, etc., etc. What if you could get those departments in a box as an AI agent, right? So that me, by myself, or maybe a small group of people, we can have the same operational processes guided by legal constraints, but to the same quality as a larger corporation would have. You just spin up an HR department. I want to hire a new person. You spin up an agent to actually create for you a labor contract that fits your tone, your organization. I mean, normally you would have to outsource that one to a specialist or actually build such a specialist department. So what would that actually mean for how successful enterprises will look like in the near future? Do they all have to be 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 plus corporations? Or, I mean, there's this famous meme, and I think it's going to be true, that we will see the one person, $1 billion valuation company in the next, let's say, decade or so. And what does that mean for the competitive landscape? We also talked about startups and scale-ups. I used to go to a lot of startup, let's call them festivals, where startups present themselves. And what you typically see, it's typically three guys, because I work in tech, right? Three guys, one calls himself the CEO, one calls himself the COO, and one the CTO. So three people starting a business, and they model themselves on the industrial corporation. Why? Is that really needed? Is that just lack of imagination? Because we can't see another form of organizing. And now you have tools that actually help you become a proper corporation without actually building up the industrial hierarchy. And you can see I have this beef with the industrial corporation, because I know this, I mentioned it way too often in this talk.
No, I totally get that. And it sounds like as you're doing the external work and working with startups and scale-ups, that's essentially what you're bringing in, just challenging the assumptions that I think everybody has about how a business is supposed to work. Yep. And that goes to, we were talking a bit about the founder versus manager mode.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a great piece by Paul Graham. I think like you, I don't particularly agree with everything he is saying in there. But the fact that he brought it forward, right? I mean, he actually brought forward, there are different ways of organizing possible. Right. So as a startup, why do you start with the CEO structure? And if you become bigger and more successful and you have product market fit and you need to scale up, etc., why do you copy the practices and the structure of, well, the post-World War II industrial corporation? There must be alternatives. And in that piece by Paul Graham, he actually says there is an alternative, right? And he mentioned Airbnb, for instance, who apparently took a different route. And I think I said that earlier. The key thing with technology, certainly digital technology, is it gives you leeway to organize different. And every success in digital transformation, in the end, turns into how do we organize? Who gets to do what? Where? When? How? For who? All these organizational questions. So when I get to present, do workshops, and otherwise consult for external organizations, our litmus test to actually start working with this organization is that we ask them three questions. And one of the three questions is, are you willing that you need to change how you organize, right? Because actually that's the not so hidden intent with me and my partner. We're actually looking for a different way of organizing. The other question we ask is, you accept that you need others outside your organization to make things successful? That's the ecosystem angle. And the first one, that one is a bit cheeky. Well, the first question we actually asked them is, did you try other methods and did you fail? Because actually I want people to have experience on, let's say, applying the business model canvas and actually see that that tool isn't sufficient in understanding the current dynamics. But in the end, it's all about organizing differently and especially allowing others to participate, others outside your organization, in participate in you being successful for your customers. Maybe they are even your customers, right?
Yeah, I do see the importance of the human and the technology, right? Where I think people aren't paying attention is the real value that customers actually want and not trying to be all things to all people. Bill Gates once told Steve Jobs, you will never be successful because you are focused on a niche.
Yes.
And then Apple beat Microsoft to the trillion value mark. And I think it really speaks to the importance of understanding value that's not just benefits and features of a product, but rather what is the segment of your customer and how do they want to feel and what is the emotional resonance that they have and how they play within the ecosystem.
Yeah, so I think the focus on niches, and I typically say niches, I hope you allow me that one. If you operate digitally or with a service that's digitally mediated, even a niche globally can still be large enough to sustain a successful endeavor. So there's this focus on niches. That's actually is the workshop as we provide them. What would be the niche that you could participate in and who would the other participants, customers be? We call them participants because they're just more than just customers. They have skin in the game, but it's really building for, well, a shared outcome in that ecosystem. And you could have a keystone position in that one. But let's see. By the way, our workshop is called the Position Workshop. So how do you position yourself in or with respect to the rest of the ecosystem instead of how can I build an ecosystem or create an ecosystem or even own an ecosystem? Because you don't.
Right. There are many ecosystems that you're already playing in. And where is your position within that? Right.
Yeah.
And even going back to this idea of platforms and ecosystems, also thinking about what can be externalized. So many people think that either they need to own everything and do everything. But in reality, as part of the ecosystem, other people may do things better. So why incur that additional cost? So I'm assuming you look at those types of things as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because in the end, the only thing you control, at least the model as we bring it to this workshop, is the tools you provide and the rules that govern their use. But the actual interactions that play out and who actually participates in those interactions, you have little to no control over, right? I mean, take Airbnb. The original business model was an airbed and breakfast. And then somebody knocks on the door and says, I have an apartment. Can I also do that one? And as law would have it, the three founders actually discussed for a whole week whether they should allow renting out an apartment, not just an airbed, but a whole apartment on their platform. Just imagine they would have said, no, that's not us. And they still would be airbed and breakfast. I'm pretty sure we wouldn't mention them in this podcast. Right? And there are three houses on Airbnb. That's not what the product marketing department of Airbnb came up. Somebody put a treehouse in there and somebody thought it's a great idea to actually stay in a treehouse. So now there are 1,000 treehouses on there. Somebody actually invented a whole new product category. Experiences you could book on Airbnb. Somebody actually brought an experience there, not the product marketing department of Airbnb. Just suppose they would have said, no, it's not us. Stop it. I forbid it. Right? So you really outsource your innovation to the ecosystem because you can have great ideas, but there are many more people outside your organization than inside. So there are also more better ideas outside than inside. Embrace it. It's fantastic.
And one of the things that pushback I get, I have a lot of background in B2B, and my general philosophy is that the brand is the container, if you will. It's the promise, but it also informs delivery. So that means that internal operations, people, process, technologies need to be connected to the experience that needs to be connected to marketing, right? Everything working cohesively. But I get a lot of pushback from folks in B2B saying, oh, well, that doesn't work the same. So while we're giving examples like Airbnb, the fact is, B2B businesses operate exactly the same. The general principles still apply.
Yeah, I think the reason why why Airbnb pops up as an example, because it's so generally well known, right? And I get that pushback a lot too, right? So it's a bit harder to actually find B2B examples, but they exist. But also, and whenever I see the letter B and a 2 and a B, right? So B2B, I always have to add 2C. Because you also, as the first B, you also have a role in making that second B successful with respect to that last C. Again, it's about awareness that there is more than the linear relationship, right? Even if you don't like that, you can ignore it, right? You can hand yourself the illusion that it doesn't exist, but it's there. At least be aware. And then you can say, no, that's not something for us for whatever reason. That's fine. And then it's a conscious decision, but you cannot ignore it anymore.
When you're working with, let's say, scale-up founders, startups and scale-ups, what's one piece of advice or an area that you often work on where maybe they're getting stuck, they don't get it, they're resistant to it?
It's finding the right level of allowing disobedience from your ecosystem participants. There's always a very strong tendency to control everything. Right, even with startup scale-ups that are in the digital realm, right? I mean, some of them totally internalize this, that we are part of something bigger, part of our product is open source, but so many are still brought up in this and we need to control the thing. We need to have a control point. We need to have a choke point. And I get it, because you want to monetize and you want to build a sustainable business. So when we do our workshop on ecosystem innovation, and one of the rules is, the first day, you cannot talk about yourself. You don't figure in that whole conversation. Because if you don't, first thing people do, they take a sticky note, write the name of their company, and it's a dead center of the whiteboard, right? Center of the universe. And anything springs from that. That is still very hard to get across. And that's why we needed to have that rule. No talking about you. We're going to talk about the others. And then you will see, you have to trust us at the end. You have this visualization of the ecosystem, and there is one spot left, and that's yours. And it feels very natural. But this letting go of thinking about me as the alpha and omega of every narrative, that is very hard. Maybe that's a human thing. Maybe that's an indoctrination thing on how we think that a corporation should operate, what it means to monetize, what it means to be successful. I don't know, but that's the recurring thing. And that's why we have that rule in our little workshop. No talking about you. Rule number two is, you will get really, really nervous about this. And you will get angry and you will get frustrated. And I will smile then when you do, because that means it's working.
That's honestly, it's what I work on too. So I started my career in very customer facing, you know, brand CX innovation. And then I worked my way backward. And I think because of that, I was so trained as an account planner to understand a customer insight that I was always looking at the business from the outside in. And whenever I work with a client, whether that's a global company or it's somebody just starting their business, getting that perspective shift and starting with the outside and starting with the value to be created and starting with who that human being is outside of you before you start saying, but this is what I do. And everybody wants to go, but this is what I do. And so making that shift from outputs to outcomes and starting from different external perspectives and working your way backwards is, I think, one of the most important and underutilized tools, if you will.
And underappreciated. Because one of the observations I also can share is that, like I said, day and a half workshop, I want it to be a day and a half because there needs to be a night in between. So you get to sleep, but your brain goes on. And in the morning, it's always amazing what happens. But more often than not, people say, oh, day and a half. Can't we do it in 2 hours? A morning. I give you a morning, right? And this is so fundamental. And taking time for things and just going through this whole process, and I call it marinating. So let it just simmer. And it really surprises me, and it probably shouldn't, but how little time we actually give ourselves for discovering things, right? It has to be done in a morning. It has to be done in 2 hours. Can't we do this online? No, it doesn't work. Yeah, we can pretend it works, and you get a PowerPoint and everybody's happy, and then you just go on with business as usual. I'm still surprised that we need to see this. And not bragging about our work, little workshop, but we yet have to have a workshop where somebody said after a day and a half, this was a waste of time. Everybody then, wow, that was actually valuable. Why didn't we do this earlier? Yeah, that's an interesting one. But at least I hope you're going to do this more often. You need time is so important. The ingredient of time, but that's a whole podcast in itself, I assume.
No, it is. And I think just to close the loop on something that we were talking about earlier related to AI and productivity, I have recently offered a new founder program that is extra fast because we're using AI to do initial personas and draft a lot of things that you normally you'd have to spend a lot of time on. But what I'm also seeing is without the time to marinate in different perspectives, it's still really hard. We really have to have that time. And so, yeah, I think societally, we really need to start pushing back on this is not all about time savings. If we really put a focus on value and creativity and muses and doing things the most effective way, we're going to take more time.
Yeah. We constantly confuse effective and efficient, right? I mean, we use them interchangeably and they're very different things. Of course, they're very different things. I totally agree. And again, also this sleep thing, I just discovered this by accident, that when people come back after a good night of sleep, they're different. The cynical one is much more open. The one that was very enthusiastic is more balanced. I mean, what happened during night, right? I mean, this big gray thing up here just kept on milling around, and it's life, it's physiology, it's biology, it's us, right? So embracing us, I think that maybe is the way to, instead of being the professional or the hardworking, hard-nosed corporate person, let go of that one.
One more question. So as we think about O-types who are often extremely curious, dazzled by possibilities, often can maybe struggle with focus. Do you deal with that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing I had to learn myself is say no or no, not now. So what I do is that every year I make my little mission I would like to accomplish this year with some keywords. And every 6 weeks we have little bets to actually get us there. And quite often I just say no, not now, not this year. Because we're real a bit like, we love to eat anything and everything and everywhere and with everyone. So before you know it, you're all across. If you would go to LinkedIn and see my profile, you could see that in my younger years, I didn't stick around long at certain places. Half a year here, three quarters of a year there, year and a half. And now I am 11 years and 1 month at the same place. And that actually gives me discipline and focusing. Because if you go to a new job, right, you pick up new habits and new narratives, so you go on and on. And certain presentations I do, the workshops I do, they are 5, 6, 7 years old. There is material in there that's almost a decade old, right? And why is that? Because I know it works. And so the ability to say no and stick to a narrative, to a dot on the horizon, a phrase, whatever you want, I think that's the greatest gift I gave myself. And I discovered that by accident because I kept longer at this company and then you are a bit more focused. But that's the one tip I would have given to my younger self. Try and find something worth focusing on, even if it's just for 1 year.
That's the trick, right? It's finding something that's worth focusing on, something that you're really excited about instead of just a cerebral, well, I think I should do this.
Yeah. And no is no, not now. I mean, it's also hilarious that I pick things up I also did 10 years ago, 50 years ago, and now they're back in my life again. So no is always no, not now, sometime in future, right?
Nice. Amazing. Do you have any advice that you might give to either another O-type or a founder that you work with?
I really want to give advice to O-types because, I mean, at the end, I have you to almost hate for it, but you brought the word O-type in my life. And I think it's a really enticing type No, I have two things. I think O-typeness, it's a gift, not a curse. It's a gift, first and foremost, especially in the current day and age, which is not as stable as it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I mean, my father had two jobs in his life. And only two. Why two? Because he would have gotten one if they wouldn't have closed his first one. I mean, it's not happening anymore in our lives, certainly not the younger generation. And the ability to deal with uncertainty, to actually almost thrive with ambiguity, issues, difficult to rest for me, which you mentioned it earlier, I think that's a gift. Another thing I really would like to get across is that because you have that gift, it's up to you to reach out to other people and find a way for them to understand you. You cannot demand that they need to understand you. I see a lot of gifted people, or I talk to gifted people, gifted in this sense, who are frustrated that, well, they don't have a seat at the table. When they knock on the door, nobody opens. They are not listening to me. I'm sorry. That's up to you. You have this gift. You have this gift of traveling in many places, many domains, crossing many domains, connecting the dots, being the in-between person. It's up to you to find the tone and the moment and the narrative that resonates with the other. Don't complain about them. Do a bit better. Can I say that like that?
Absolutely. And I also find that some people just won't get you. So a lot of the clients I work with is, okay, I've tried everything. Cool. So how about we find somewhere that really loves your nonlinear way of being? Like, go there instead of just continuing to beat your head against a wall year after, which is what I did, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so maybe then to add to my little advice, the adoption curve by Jeffrey Moore. People will know
adoption
that, right?
Curve.
The innovative all the way to the laggards. The people I focus are at either side of the chasm. That's it. I'm not looking for the late majority and for sure not the laggards, right? And that's fine. I just look for the early adopters and the early majority. Yeah, it's fine if some people just think he's wishy-washy. The other week, somebody told me, yeah, I've seen you speak several times and you're full of bullshit. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for... that's fine too. I'm not here to please anyone. I'm just looking for, especially at the both sides of the chasm, can I find resonance there? And if the answer is yes, then I'm happy. And everything else, it's fine. A focus, again, there it is. It's also a form of focus.
Definitely is. Amazing. We have rambled. I'm going to have a lot of fun attempting to edit this. Really appreciated you being on the show.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's for sure a pleasure. And I hope that came across.
Thank you for tuning in to O-Types Rising. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. It really helps us to reach more listeners like you. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And please feel free to share this with other visionary, curious connectors in your network.